we're good to go. Hi there, good evening. What a fantastic crowd, very glamorous here tonight. We have David Carr and Michael Enright, and this feels a little more like a TIFF premiere than a confab on the future of journalism. So thank you so much for joining us this evening. I'm Natalie Turvey, the Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and on behalf of the Foundation's Board of Directors, I am thrilled to welcome you to our season opener of CJFJ Talks Journalism Matters, our forum series where we explore the challenges and issues and facing next generation journalism. This year, our series, under the guidance of program chairs Jeff Dvorkin and Kathy English, will focus on innovation and ideas to support new generation journalism and how quality, relevant journalism can survive and thrive in a shifting or shifted media landscape. Before we start to figure out the future of journalism, I'd like to thank our sponsors, BMO Financial Group, for their generous support of our CJF talks and their our programming throughout the year, and the Globe and Mail for their collaboration and their support of this evening's reception. Please join me in welcoming to the stage the Globe and Mail's public editor, Sylvia Stead, to say a few words. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, the Globe and Mail is very pleased to be sponsoring tonight's reception, and I wanted to thank and credit the CJF. They do a fabulous job of honing in on the key journalistic issues of the day and somehow managed to get the absolute best speakers on every topic, tonight's being no exception. And I'm interested to watch David tonight. Our media columnist Simon Haupt did a Q&A with David in which he described him as Grampy Pants, an avatar, a rock star, and online catnip. So I'm hoping we're going to see all of those things tonight. And for all of you who are going to be tweeting on this, there should be a lot of Twitter envy because David has almost 380,000 followers on Twitter. An absolutely stunning number, and many more readers, I'm sure. His talk tonight on The Sky is Falling, what now is the subject we're all grappling with, but I think many of us are like me. I'm very confident on the future of journalism. I think journalism has a very bright future and it will flourish. The question is how and what is it going to look like? Because our readers want to know what we know. They want to hear our voices. They're more than ever interested in everything we do. So that is our challenge. And so I'm looking for insight from Michael and David on the now what genius part of the talk. So thank you.
Good evening. My name is Bob Lewis. I'm chair of the Journalism Foundation. It's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight and to also welcome the viewers of CPAC, the national cable company that does the public affairs channel. We're very fortunate, David, as I told you earlier, to have you here to kick off our fall season. We thank you for causing this sellout. It's caused a little bit of grief because a lot of people are on the waiting list, and we'll so remain. If you want to play on this, it's the hashtag is CJFJTalk. This is a monthly series, and it's one way we focus on excellence in journalism. We also extend the dialogue through two of the websites that we fund, JSource and ProJG, and through our professional development programs and our annual awards gala. All of this takes resources, and so we need your support and your participation. So that's the end of the commercial. This month, Michael Enright is marking his 12th season as host of CBC Radio 1's The Sunday Edition. It's an oasis of smart talk and stimulating interviews. He's come a long way in his life. He received a Southern Fellowship for Journalism in 1979. Last year, he got an honorary degree from York University. But I believe his prized possession is the honorary degree he received in 2009 from his old high school, St. Mike's, which he abandoned in 1960. Michael, like so many of the great ones, started in print. He worked at the Globe and Mail and the Star. He was an exceptionally eloquent writer with Time and Maclean's, where we first started to conspire, and then one of the news executives who ushered Maclean's into the news magazine era. At the CBC, he hosted This Morning for 3 years, and he spent 10 years hosting CBC radios, As It Happens. That's really where he made his mark for breaking the boundaries of standard news broadcasting. I remember, Michael, hearing your interview with Radovan Karadzic, Mr. Mike, as he kept calling you. And frankly, you really weren't getting far with the obfuscation of the Bosnian bully. And so what did Michael do? He threw a haymaker at him. So, he says, how is the ethnic cleansing going?
Nice.
I give you Mr. Mike.
Thank you, Robert. It's very interesting, the geography of this place. Don Newman and Margaret Winty, John McFarlane. We all worked here when it was the Globe and Mail, before it was sold over to Moloch. And the great doors of the Globe we used to come into every day after crossing the ITU picket line and having things thrown at us. I did that for 6 or 7 years. It was a great time. And it's a privilege to be here to introduce our guest tonight. In 1882, if we go back a ways, Oscar Wilde made a trip across the United States. And everywhere he stopped, he had a press conference and talked to people and journalists and so on. At one point, he was in Des Moines, Iowa, and he was asked some questions about America, and he said, the American president reigns for 4 years, and journalism governs forever and ever. And going back forever and ever, there have always been pulse takers and critics of the state of journalism, some of them pretty good. H.L. Mencken in the 20s and 30s, A.J. Liebling in the 40s and 50s, Michael Arlen in the 60s, Alexander Coburn and Eric Alterman in the 80s and 90s, and our special guest tonight. But I'm fairly sure he would eschew the title of critic. David Carr says he writes a reporting column. Yes, it has opinion, but it also tells a story, often one that nobody else has covered. I come away from each and every Carr column having learned something. We've all seen the documentary which focused on how our guest goes about reporting for The Times. It centered on Mr. Carr's amazing story of the implosion of the Tribune Company and the awful fallout on journalism and journalists. He engages in what we dinosaurs used to call shoe leather reporting, getting out and actually talking to people. And in my experience, that makes him something of a rarity. But then, of course, he is. David Carr was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1956, one of seven in an Irish Catholic family. The best ones always are. He attended the University of Minnesota, where he took a double major in psychology and journalism. He's the former editor of the Twin Cities Reader and the Washington City Paper. His 2008 memoir, The Night of the Gun, is remarkable. It's a chilling telling of his past experience with drug addiction and alcoholism. It is a mesmerizing narrative, but it is also a masterclass in talking about how a journalist goes about reporting his own life. He has described himself as a thug who works for the New York Times. He lives in Montclair, New Jersey, with his wife Jill and their three children. And at a time when the very underpinnings of journalism seem to be under assault, it is indeed important to have him with us here tonight. Mr. David Carr.
Thank Welcome, sir.
Well, that's quite a warm-up, dude.
Thank you.
Whoa!
Like your glass?
I listened to that that big, long, warm, wonderful thank you for those kind words. And I'm always surprised that at the end that I'm the one who starts talking.
That's the point of it all.
It's like when I'm at the airport and the luggage drops down and mine comes down. It's got a business card from the New York Times on it. And I just say some terrible mistake has been made. Can't believe this is mine.
I mentioned the president and the election and all of that. And I want to get, before we get into some of the other issues, how would you assess the coverage of the presidential election so far in the U.S.?
I think the mainstream coverage, what I've been reading in the Wall Street Journal, what I've been reading in Politico, what I've been reading in the New York Times has been pretty darn good. One of the things I did before the convention started, I did one of those columns about how little nutrition there was available in them and what an empty exercise they were. And I gradually realized it's because I decided not to go that they suddenly became unimportant. And as a viewer at home, I learned stuff.
You did.
Like
you did.
I watched and I felt that there was clear messaging on both parties, that you got a good sense of what's going on, and that it kicked the ball down the road. My concern is that we have these big signal events, and then we all reassemble into these verticals of interest, and that, I mean, if you want to go out on the web and find out that our president is a Kenyan, you can find that out and say, there it is, right there in black and white. He's a Kenyan. And if you want to find out that Mitt Romney has made a life's work out of doing harm to poor people and putting them out of work at every turn, it's out there. And I do think that there's been a loss of a village common. I noticed, I think we talked about this, so there's a picture where Obama walks into a pizza parlor, a Republican pizza parlor, and this guy has done enormous work on behalf of his community, as a pillar of his community. And Obama perhaps seeking a photo op and maybe some political gain, but rightfully stop it and say, you know, thanks for being you.
Yeah.
You're one of the good ones. And the guy spontaneously picks him up and hugs him. And I don't know, as an American citizen, I found that moving. I thought that was, I mean, this guy, he's not exactly huggable, apart from being the president. He's a pretty stiff dude. And this big Florida guy just picked him up and hugged him. And then I watched what happened to that picture afterwards. And people, you know, some guy writing and saying, you should have squeezed him like the zitty was and popped him and blah. And this vile, horrendous stuff that just burbles along in these verticals of interest. I mean, anytime I veer towards something vaguely political in what I write, whether it's about Jon Stewart or about the Obama administration or about Fox News, the comments, you have to wear goggles to go in there.
I want to ask about the craft. There, Michael Lewis has a huge profile in Vanity Fair about Obama. He had extraordinary access. It turns out he had to clear his copy with the senior staff at the White House. Reporters on the campaign trail have to clear their quotes with senior staff, either with Romney or Obama. Now, that hasn't come up here yet. Maybe our politicians don't say anything worth quoting, but the idea of having the politicians vet the journalist quotes. What do you make of that?
Well, the political process, including the conventions, are so carefully stage managed, and the messages are massaged to the point where there's not a wrinkle anywhere. And the only shot you have of anything resembling something spontaneous is the quote. Mm-hmm. This is the last refuge of spontaneity. And now they want to rub that out. And I do think that I used to cover Hollywood. I covered the Oscars on the red carpet.
Yeah, you were there all the time.
4 and 5 years.
Yeah.
Rather unlikely figure on a red carpet. I've been muscled off it a few times. Looked like a homeless guy wandering around. I did, during the Oscars, go in. Here's the thing about the Oscars. Don't ever try and drive there. LA is a car city, and the whole security apparatus is built on you showing up, getting in this remote thing. And I was staying not that far away, and I, you know, put on my asbestos tuxedo that I bought at Men's Warehouse and, you know, schlepped down the street. And I couldn't get in. Because I didn't come in a car. And so my only job was to be out on the carpet feeding quotes inside. I was a full-time Oscar blogger. I was, and I made video. But on that day, it was very important that I feed quotes in. And you have to get there early because you're covering a West Coast event for East Coast deadlines. So the clock is ticking on you. And I couldn't get in. And so I finally just busted him, moved the wrong way up the carpet. And yeah, I got thrown out. What were you talking about?
We were talking. Gee, I forget. No. All right.
Here's where I was going. The amount of management around those stars in terms of access was just breathtaking. Okay. And the kabuki that went around them, and there's all these pilot fish that feed on famous people, and their job is to screw you over again and again and avoid their clients, as in Washington, slipping up and actually saying something truthful.
All right, but let's pretend that you're a reporter on the campaign trail, and you're covering Romney or Obama or Biden or somebody, and he makes a speech, and you know that in the course of the speech, he tells a lie, a whopper. Some people suggest that Congressman Ryan did that at the convention in Tampa. Do you report that as a lie?
Well, let me just back up to this quote thing to make one more point about it is I do think that we have given up significant real estate and territory by playing ball. They wait till you're up on deadline, and then they say clear quotes. And now on my beat, the media beat, people who are paid to be in the media, I'm getting the same crap out of spokespeople. And I have to say to them, look, dude, you're paid to talk. That's your only skill. And I'm not that horrible of a typist that I can't get down what you're gonna say, and no, I'm not gonna clear your quotes, or maybe I will if it's in my interest. I mentioned my boss, I'm writing about this week, and I said, yeah, I've had to clear quotes with Time Warner before, and he just like looked at me, and I was like, I don't think I should have said that just now. So
would you report a lie if you knew it to be a lie?
Yeah, well, I kind of hear where you're going with this, and I think that did people come away from the Republican convention unclear that some of the statements that Mr. Ryan said may not have reflected a full engagement with the truth? No, they did not. And what folks like you, I think, want is people to jump up in the middle and say, that's a damn lie. And they want them to say it only to one side over and over again. And there is, I don't think at the end of it that the American public will be misinformed about what is a lie and what is truthful. I think we're living in a golden age where the internet has become a sort of self-cleaning oven, and misstatements gradually move toward more and more truth about them over time.
All right, I want to get to that golden age in a moment, but you use a technique in interviewing that I have never used, and I don't know many people who have, where you will ask a source, what do you think the story is? Tell me what you think this story is. And of course, the convention is you never say that to a source because it's your story. You're the one who's writing it, but you want to know what they think it is. Why?
I like that question. One of the conceits of literary immersive journalism is that you're there, and you're there for a long time. Michael Lewis's story reflects a profound level of access, and you feel like you get to know the present better. What are people immersed in? They're immersed in their own lives, and they're immersed. So for me, you know, I have the attention span of a gnat. I did a story about a book a week ago. I'm doing a story for the magazine about something entirely. And each time I'm like an, you know, instant expert. I show up and go, I'm here from the media. I'm here to help, you know, and I know your secret inner soul. And I think it behooves a person to say, you know, you've been living this life forever, and you've been dealing with this issue forever. What do you think the story is about? One of my problems, a little digression, but during 9/11, I was working at New York Magazine, which was not like the New York Magazine it is right now. It wasn't like huge. We were mostly kind of a party magazine. And then one of the signal events of the last century occurred in the town that we covered. And the editor was like, you go north, you go south. Carr, you cover firemen. Well, I've done cop reporting, but I've never done fireman reporting in New York, very specific sort of thing, totally unsourced, don't know where the... And what is the question that you're walking in with? So, your best friend's dead. How do you feel about that? And they're not really into the media anyway. So my idea was, one of my colleagues, her friend had been killed in the attacks. She wasn't working the story, but she's incredibly empathetic presence, and people just love talking to her. And I just said, how about you come and stand by me? Just come to me. You don't have to work at all. Just be with me. And she just got one of those heads that goes back and forth while you talk, and she kind of pulls on her hair, and people, she's calming in a way I'm not. Yeah. So we got all done. She said, I'm very impressed by your reporting, your ability to really get in there and dig around. Did you ever notice that when just about the time they're going to say something interesting, you tend to pipe up? And I'm like, can I swear a little? Jesus Christ, I've been doing this for 20 years. What you say is not true, and I'm totally hurt by what you said. And a month later, I was doing something for The Atlantic about Homeland Security, and I had my takedown source guy was CIA, former FBI guy, knew more about Homeland Security than almost anybody, and this is a very fresh topic. And he was my source. And right when he was going to answer my most important critical question, I piped up and started braying about something I had learned in the last 2 weeks. So I'm trying to...
Yeah.
I'm trying to like stop talking, ask people what they think, just close my pie hole.
There have been, I think, the last number I saw.
Not
Jeff,
tonight, though.
Something like 15,000 journalists and editors in the U.S. have lost their jobs. Newspapers are closing, and I pick up David Carr, an interview in which he says we're entering into a golden age of journalism.
Well, on the one hand, if you look at the last week, Journal Register declares bankruptcy. Patriot News goes to 3 days a week. Philly Inquirer and Daily News goes to the unions
Rocky
and
Mountain News,
says, we want concessions right now. It's just 1 week of sudden tumbling. And the pension overhang in the U.S. newspaper industry is going to create a lot of misery. And so,
quite a golden age then, isn't it?
Well, it depends on where you're looking. I mean, if the column I'm working on this week about packaging quotes, I Twittered out what I was up to. I set up a separate Gmail called Quote Approve. I sent emails to 40 of the best reporters I know. And, you know, when I type them into my Gmail, their names just pop because I have this. Your Gmail knows everything, right? It's an amazing database. And I'm going to be able to check what people say against all known thought. I'll probably make a video about it when I'm done. And then I'll Twitter out my column. I'll have a chat with people about what's doing. I'll put a nice fat picture on my Facebook, and 100,000 subscribers will be there. I'll carve my own route to the ocean. And so, I don't know, that seems sort of golden to me, right until I don't have a job. Then that part's bad. Like, if I'm typing along and...
You're bigger than Walt Disney. I mean, you have 300 and some odd thousand followers on...
About half of them are real, probably.
That's Reverend Moon territory, isn't it?
I mean, it's bigger than a lot of U.S. newspapers, I'll say that.
But you were very slow coming to Twitter. You were suspicious of it and nervous about it, and you never... How did you get into all of this? The new news 2.0?
South by Southwest and the whole news platform. That's a media technology and film conference in Austin, Texas. And the entire sort of news platform was Twitter, and it was all just zinging over my head. And I thought, I have to enter the narrative. Even if I don't tweet, I have to listen and I have to follow. And I came to believe within a year, and I wrote a pretty big op-ed piece about why Twitter will endure, that it's a very steady platform because it doesn't require reciprocity. I didn't, on Facebook, everybody said, "Will you be my friend?" I'm like, "Yes, yes, 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 yes." And pretty soon I got 4,000 friends, and my feed is of no utility. I got, a very nice young man from Somalia that's my pal, but the Venn diagram of the intersect of our interests is low.
So, but how do you use Twitter as in your reporting? How do you?
It's a human-enabled RSS. All my competitors and all the like-minded people on Twitter are constantly finding and pushing stuff again and again. So instead of having an RSS set up, I've got all these humans out there searching, and the best tweeters, and we're stuck with this language. It's horrible. Tweeters. Are people who are tweeting out links over and over. And so the metadata that's in Twitter, every 4 seconds there's a tweet that carries information about the New York Times.
What do you do? I'm in Palm Springs. I'm having a Ben and Jerry's. Isn't that fantastic?
That's what people like you always use to make fun of it. And it's...
Well, how do you use it? How do you use the information?
This is not something that goes off on the surface of the moon. Give it a look. I mean, Jesus. If you follow, Simon, who wrote this story today, you learned in the Globe and Mail, you learned a ton about what's going on in the world. Today, the new public editor of the New York Times wrote about the photograph that the Times published of the dead ambassador. And right when she did it, I tweeted that out and said, she's doing a reporting. Turns out the embassy wanted them, no, not the embassy, the State Department wanted them to take it down. She wrote about it. And if you had been following me, you would have known about that the minute it happened. It helps you see over the hill.
Do you fact check tweets and do you fact check blogs?
What do you mean by fact check?
Something comes up and you look at it. And
well, it's the public editor of the New York Times. I assume she's a reliable source. I mean, have I ever made a mistake on Twitter? Yes, I've prematurely tweeted stuff. But if it involves issues of civic or national moment or death or significant felony crimes, yeah, I'm not going to be real quick on the Twitter finger.
You wrote a column, a fascinating column about Yahoo. And in it, I think the head was, what is Yahoo anyway? But in the middle of the column, you used the phrase commodity journalism.
Right.
What is that?
Well, it's like, my kids know everything, right? They're a narrative on everything. If I tell them, you know, that the Libyan, our ambassador to Libya is dead, they'll say, I know. How do they know that, right? Did they get that off a zipper in Times Square? Did they get it at the grocery checkout line? Did it come from the elevator? Was it on their Facebook feed? Did they find out on Dig? Did a friend send them a text with the picture? There's this whole burbling mass of news that's like an ionized atmosphere that we move through. And most of it is commodity stuff. And one of the existential threats to journalism is the fact that people don't really care that much about where stuff comes from. And in my colleague Brian Stelter's a story he did a couple years ago, he talked to somebody. I thought what they said was profound. They said, if something is important, it will find me.
And so it will find him.
It will find me. And again, that we live in a mediated age where important information will find you. And the most important source of information are the people that you like and trust.
So the reporter then is a kind of receptacle of information and kind of sits there and it comes to him or her.
Reporters, I mean, there's a difficult choice to be made, because at what point do you quit consuming information and produce information? That's not something we used to think about a lot. Back when you worked in this building, you worked the phone, you read Lexis, you checked the clip file, you maybe grabbed a couple books, and around 4:30 or 5 o'clock, your editor started giving you the hairy eyeball, like, where is your copy? Hemingway, where is it?
Absolutely.
And whereas now, it's like, at what point do you stop taking it in and push it out? And again, I'm confronted, I think I told Simon this, I'm not sure, but the night that Osama bin Laden was killed, I gradually noticed that where it first showed up was on Twitter. A guy heard helicopters, there's a military operation near my town, and Pakistan, and that bubbled up. Everybody pointed at him, and I was like, well, wow, there's a media component to a very important story. I better hop on our blog and write about it. And I went to open it up and write it, and frickin' Brian Stelter already had 900 words sitting there.
All right, a couple of years ago in this town, a tweet went out
saying... But wait, though. I just want to tell you, while he was taking information in... he was pushing it out.
But what was he pushing out?
He was pushing out everything that was known at the time. So he was, he'd read, and he opened up a WordPress file the minute he saw.
2 years ago in this town, a report went out that the prime minister had to be rushed to hospital because he was choking on some home fries he was eating for breakfast.
Poutine?
Not poutine. No.
Checking.
Not far from here.
Had a little bit today, just saying.
It was total bullshit.
Right.
My organization, CBC, reported that the Prime Minister was choking. Other news outlets reported the same thing. The Prime Minister was in Ottawa in his residence. It would have taken one phone call to a bureau to find out where Harper was. Yet it went across the blogosphere that he had choked on home fries. I don't even think he eats home fries.
Yeah, look back over your career. I don't think that the Twitter bus pulled error into view. I think television has been making huge mistakes. Dewey Truman. I know that people like you who are fundamentally skeptical of social media think it has introduced an age when information lacks efficacy, but I think things tend to move toward correctness much, much more quickly. Does it put the gun in the hands of some people that shouldn't have it? Maybe. But maybe over time we're going to make the adjustment. I mean, we didn't fall for the Supreme Court thing.
No, CNN did.
Other people Fox did. I wasn't going to mention any names.
I'm thrilled at the phrase people like you, but don't move on.
Well, I know it's Canada, but we're supposed to have a little conflict here.
All right,
right?
I agree.
I mean, we'll hug afterwards.
At one point, the New York Times asked you to make a series of videos, which you did in the basement of your house, and the boiler kept blowing up and making noise and so on, and you gave it up because you said the videos looked like hostage videos. Now, were you derelict in your duty? Were you rejecting a particular form of new media, of social media, that you were down in the basement with a white shirt on and a nice blue blazer, and you didn't want to go on looking like a hostage video?
Part of what's going on, and this doesn't happen in the print version of the New York Times. We don't like, oh yeah, why don't you give that a whirl? That isn't. We don't give it a whirl in the print version. And again on in digital realms, it's iterate. Try stuff, see what works. And I had done videos for the Oscars in which I was kind of a man on the street, and I would work Times Square, I'd work the red carpet, and they went really, really well. And they got lots of spins and lots of traffic, and even though I'm not what you would think of as an Oscar reporter, it worked out really well. And so then I said, I got an idea. Why don't you make a TV studio in my basement, and every single day I'll make a video, and I want to...
Why? Why did you want to do that?
Because I just had a wonderful experience of connecting. I'll give you an example I was starting to do these videos, and I walked up to Brad Gray, who I'd never met, who runs Paramount, and I said, my name is David Carr. I work for the New York Times. I'm writing this blog about the Oscars. And he says, I know you. I see you on my iTunes every single week. I love what you're doing, man. And it's like, I thought, well, I'm growing sources. I'm growing audience. There's a lot of people that would watch these videos that probably wouldn't be reading the New York Times. So my idea was, well, let's do it every day. And so they came out and built a fully enabled studio in my basement. And I wanted to be able to write, produce, edit, and post all by myself. And be sort of in control of the means of production. Couldn't push the button. Couldn't say, this is fine, it'll go. But everything else would belong to me. And as it turns out, in the same way, if I was over there standing by myself, it would not be nearly so good as me and you talking. Me alone is a bad neighborhood. Yeah. And you could just see, I was like looking into the camera, and you could almost smell the dead bodies in my basement. It's just like, and so we did it for 30 days, and everybody looked at it and said, hey, these really suck. And we moved on. So now I make a video every single week with A.O. Scott, our film critic. And we develop a topic. We talk about it in the lunchroom. We go and find one of our colleagues who knows a lot of stuff. And then we chat about it some more, and it leaves.
It is charming. I love it. I watch it on the computer.
Right.
Is it journalism?
No, not really. It, I mean, Is everything you see?
I'm not being a purist. I just want to know if
a little bit.
All right. It's the Irish Catholic.
But wait though.
Look at
the Globe and Mail. Great paper, right? Wonderful paper.
Yes.
How much of that paper is actually journalism? I'm just saying that we do recipe.
How much of the paper tells me something I didn't know before I picked it up?
Well, Tony and I are telling you all kind of stuff that you didn't know. A lot of newspapers through the years has been built on not everything has to be about it's a package. It's some issues of cultural moment, civic moment, and then some stuff that's just fun. And like Tony Scott is the best, one of the best working critics in America. And so what we talked about this week, what'll be coming out is, why are there all these adaptations that you're seeing at TIFF right now? Why are so many hefty literary works being developed, and are they working? I don't know if it's journalism, but it's like it has significant value. Like when he talked, I was interested.
Monday, the first thing I look at Monday morning in the Times is your column. I don't care what you're doing with Tony Scott on the.
Well, that hurts. That warns me.
Have a glass of water. No, seriously.
Mine's vodka.
I read David Carr because I get more out of the reading of it than the looking at it.
If all we do is satisfy your interests, we're going to be out of business when you die.
You reckon?
So I'm really interested in refreshing the demographic from below, from giving an invitation to people on all kinds of platforms and letting them, if they want to get to know me on Twitter and maybe take some baby steps into actually reading what I write and over time develop an interest in what that, to say, yeah, let's just feed people that look like me and you and see how that goes. That's not going to work out very well.
All right, what is it when you said a couple of times, and you wrote this actually, you said that the internet is a self-cleaning oven. It's like when the nuns used to say the Trinity is a mystery. What the hell does that mean, a self-cleaning oven?
That when something is false, that over time, that people are going to know fairly quickly that the prime minister is not sick and that he's at home and that a reflex will kick in and that some really... what happens is even in crowdsourced situations, when you talk about the Arab Spring, where there's all these different, somewhat unknown, somewhat unreliable data inputs, citizen journalism come flying in, what rises to the top and what gets attention is usually the best.
Is that right? Is that
true? Yes, and that there's... That the crowds are wise. I mean, the crowds also want to know about the Kardashians' breast implants, but in other aspects, in aspects of news, there is, if you look at like Andy Carvin, who served as kind of a clearinghouse on Twitter for Arab Spring News, he was a really big deal. I learned a lot from following him, and he would ask people to check out specific rumors in neighborhoods, and it was a way...
This was raw data, though. I mean, how did you... And this is unmitigated. It's not edited. It doesn't go through any kind of familiar process. How do we know to use the word citizen journalist? It's like citizen dentist. I mean, do I trust what I'm hearing or reading?
Well, let's say that all you had was mainstream inputs from Syria right now, you wouldn't know anything. You wouldn't see anything.
It's on the front page of the New York Times. I know a fair bit. No?
If you want to see the kind of warfare that's two photographers I know really well have died. It's a conflict full of asymmetry. Historically, journalism stays safe by knowing where to stand. in Syria, there's no safe place to stand.
Right.
And so you end up, you know, we lost one of our most important voices in the Middle East trying to cover that conflict. And yet there's still video coming out of those neighborhoods. There's bloggers that have become known as trusted sources. And the world, if the whole world wants to watch, or even a part of it wants to watch, there's something to see. And if let's use your dentistry metaphor, which is what people like you always say, is let's say that there were no dentists in a certain part of the world. And Mike Randall down the street, turns out he's pretty handy with the pliers. Turns out he can get a bad tooth out. Would you say, oh, there are no dentists, but I'm certainly not engaging in citizen dentistry. No, God, no. Michael's not taking my tooth out. I'll let it rot, take my entire brain out. There are spots, there are gaps in what the world knows. And I'm not, believe me, I don't want to talk about a utopia. All we got to do is vaporize all the journalists and then everything will, somebody has to make the phone calls. Somebody has to put in the shoe leather. Somebody has to do it. But I do think that we're moving, I mean, to the point of sort of what we're talking about is old media isn't adopting the tools of the insurgency and moving more toward them. New media is beginning to get into the business of fact-checking, of thinking before they speak, of actually making phone calls. And we're moving toward a hybrid media that will be, you know, enabled by all these tools that we are talking about. What's sort of the tougher part is what's the business model that goes with that? I mean, in the U.S., Gawker is doing fairly well. And Gawker's actually broke some stories.
Yes, it has. Yeah. But is there a danger, though? Because I know network reporters, and foreign correspondents, and on our network and others, they're filing all the time. They're filing every 15 or 20 minutes, whether to the podcast or the network or whatever. And I'm wondering how you find the time to construct context, how you find the opportunity when you're filing all the time. How do you put together the full story?
I think you really have put your finger on the hidden cost of the sort of media age that we're living in terms of chronicity and productivity are the main metrics of, like, can he or she do it? Can she do it? And what the editor wants to know, can they crank on a variety of platforms? Can she get on a camera without projectile vomiting? Can she type in full sentences? Does she have a Twitter following? And so that's one thing. One thing I sort of worry about, like I had a couple weeks ago, I did something for Sunday Arts and Leisure about Errol Morris's new book, suggesting that Jeffrey McDonald. So it's like a 2,000-word piece, and it involves not just his book, but Joel McGinnis's book, but Susan Orlean's book.
Janet Malcolm.
Janet Malcolm's book. And plus this long-running argument in American journalism, and I had all these interviews. And my ability is to sort of hold all these things suspended and then come up with a good synthetic through line on them, I felt was a little bit impaired. I felt was that I'd been speaking and burping out in such short bursts. And the time when you sort of step back and think about things is becoming less and less. And you become so busy as a consumer of media that you don't really run the analytics on it. The other thing that I worry about is like, I think of myself as kind of a horse, you know, stamina, that I did not come from like brilliant stock. My people were chased by people on horses. They didn't, you know, we didn't own the horses. And so we're like workers, we're earners. And that's what I'm always telling my kids. And the thing is, I'm really tired, I gotta say. I'm tired. I wonder about. I've done a good job of keeping up with the variety of skills that you need to be a journalist. But I'm not a digital native. I don't consume and produce media at the same time. And like, I haven't been blogging that much lately. And it's partly because, yeah, a little tired. And you wonder. I think of my friends, many of whom make the argument, not that this stuff will go away, but it's just like, I'm not gonna do it. I'm sure there's value in Twitter somewhere. I'm sure Reddit is really important. I'm not gonna open up that part of my life and let those things in. I never argue with them. I never say, oh, that's, well, you're a dinosaur, you're screwed, because Who's to say? So I've done a good job of sort of building my way into a more complicated future, but I've sort of gone slowly crazy while I've done it. So it's like, oh, what are you, nuts? Don't you want to be crazy like me? They did a travel story, and the travel editor brings me in and says, what do you do when you go on a vacation? I said, well, I check Yelp to see what everybody eats where I goes, and then I look at, I look at this, I do that. And she just said, I'm going to send you a place where you can't do anything. And she put me on a deserted island with the, you know, like.
No Wi-Fi.
No, nothing, right? Just two coconuts to slam together. And.
How did it work? How did it go?
It was absolutely wonderful. I gotta say, I thought, oh man, I'm gonna be, you know, every once in a while the helicopters fly over. That's the only outside world, because it was Caribbean, the drug interdiction. And that, you know, I'm gonna be, you know, taking clamshells and putting them on the beach and arranging 140 word tweets to get the word out. Here's the thing about all that, when you go away from it, it goes away. It goes away.
You said at some point, you told somebody, I can't remember exactly the quote, but you were afraid that you're going to spend a lot of your life going around and explaining new media to media people rather than, and the fear was you wouldn't be using it as much or something. The idea that, I guess since the documentary came out, everybody wants to talk to David Carr and everybody wants to hear from David Carr. Is that a problem?
Well, you don't want to be one of these people that talks about their job instead of does it. Uh-huh. And that's really, I'm right close on that. There's, because would, you know, as narcissistic and as egotistical as I am, and all I ever wanted was to, like, the reason I got involved in journalism is a friend of my dad's had been beaten up and by the police, and it's like, you know, somebody should write a story about that. And my dad said, well, didn't you just go to college for, what, 7 years to do that? And so I did this story. It was hard, right? And it was scary, but that part where, like, the paper came out and my name was on the front of it was just... electric, right?
It's what did your father think of that?
He thought it was a good story. I mean, he thought it was, I went and found the truth, why this guy got beat up, and the cops ended up getting fired, and no, it was all great, but that the sort of ego needs that were met by also was part of what hooked me in. At a certain point, like here, what does the future journalism feel a little bit of a fraud about that? Because like, answer's different than it was 6-8 months ago, and
it'll be different 6 months from now.
Yeah, and I was in Brazil, which is a couple of years behind us, and their newspapers are still storming along. And I can remember just sitting at the dais and going, I'm totally making this up right now. I really don't know what is going to happen. Because the media beat, when they gave me my column at the New York Times, 2005, I was like, I don't want to write about the media. Nothing ever happens. It's just, oh, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. Nothing ever changed. And then right when I started doing the column, like boom, 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 all this stuff started happening. And the threat to the business model in the United States is profound, is profound.
The part of the—
Think of this. Okay, at the conventions.
Yeah.
Okay, CNN, it's not the best thing there ever was, right? But they're kind of trying to go up the middle and tell you what's going on, right? They make mistakes. They're not terrific. Yeah. There's people on there I wouldn't watch with your eyes. But in general, they're trying to. They got clobbered by MSNBC, clobbered during the Democratic convention.
There's a full page ad in today's New York Times from CNN saying they beat the crap out of MSNBC.
Probably at both conventions. I mean, televisions are always measurement periods in the demo, blah blah blah. That person, but think about that is the sort of news part of that, of the cable news, done.
You're lucky to be alive, and not doing hard time.
Yes, on both counts, true.
You've survived cancer,
right?
You have fewer body parts than you're born with.
Missing a few.
Yeah. You came off 13 or 14 years of, I think you said, a flat-out maniac.
I prefer to think of it as kind of a social crack user, but go ahead.
How did you get into it, and how did you get out of it?
You're not going to ask me about ethnic cleansing, are you?
No, 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 no.
Things took a little hard turn here. Okay. since I was 4 years old, I like to spin around and feel different. Just like the feeling of altered states. And my gateway chemical in high school, I began smoking cigarettes, which is an addiction that is with me still to this day. Put me in proximity of people who were smoking pot, who were then doing LSD, and then by the time I graduated to college, there was a variety of sort of pharmacological solutions to this combination of studying and partying that we were doing. And then at the age of 21, I tried cocaine, and I thought I had discovered some new continent. I thought it was the most amazing, like, this is it. This is, and, you know, other people try coke and, you know, then they end up coming home at 4 a.m. and don't remember what happened and panties at their ankles and like, what? And they don't do it again. And me, I woke up and went, yeah, that was great. And, you know, I got into smoking it, which is just this endless, like, lab rat activity that you have this certain supply of endorphins, and you ring the bell once, and then you spend years and years and years trying to get back to that one perfect place.
You told Charlie Rose one point that when you woke up in the morning, you knew that your life was chaos and the day would be chaotic. And hey, what would make it a bit easier? And it would be a drink.
Well, think about as somebody who's captured in the cycle of addiction, and they wake up, there's no food in the house, they're sore, maybe they've gotten in a fight the night before, their head hurts, they don't have much money, they don't really have a job, and so you're surrounded, you're implicated by everything that you see. And all you've done is open your eyes, right? And you look around and your place is trashed and your the light bulb is out and you're surrounded by dysfunction. And it's like, who wouldn't want to put on the beer goggles and look at that? It's like anything to take the edge off of this. You feel bad because your life sucks. And what you end up sort of, you're addicted to escape, but what you're in absolute profound loss of is hope. And so that's where the chronicity of the activity comes, is you feel a sense of hopelessness and you address it through applying mood altering chemicals again and again and again.
But where's the frontier that you have to cross where you say, I'm either going to die or I'm going to stop?
I don't think for your average junkie, their own mortality is a big motivator. It's like if you're really using and using an extreme, what you're trying to do is come as close to dying as you can, but not. I mean, people, how do people overdose? Because they're always trying to walk right up to the edge of overdose without actually doing it. So the idea of death, it sounds like a release. I have a strong like will to live, but what I ended up getting my dope dealer pregnant, and you know they
married her.
Yeah, huh? No,
that was Nan. No.
Yeah, I didn't marry her, but I did get her pregnant, and she did have these kids, and I was out with them. She was gone. She'd been gone for a while, and she was a fellow addict, and.
You had the two. You had the kids.
Yeah, I had the kids, and I was out of dope. And I went to the dope house, and I ran inside for 5 minutes to get something, and came out 3 hours later. And it was cold. It was Minnesota, and it was like, and I just thought, you know, I've been a bad husband, been a bad brother, been a bad son, been a bad employee. You know, my family, and again with the Irish Catholic crapola, but being a bad father. You know, that was something God probably wouldn't forgive. And so I just thought, I'm just not going to be able to explain this part of it to anybody.
You go to Mass on Sunday.
Yeah, not a bunch. We switched priests lately, and I'm not too happy about the new guy. Rome is there. I don't care what those guys do. It's like, I had Father Jack for years, and he seemed like a pretty good dude, and I really have no idea what I'm doing there. Things tended to go better when I showed up. But then we got this hot dog in from, and he's got his marching orders from the bishops, and I'm less excited to see what he's got going. Boy, we're really ranging around here.
Before I leave, I want to posit the following. Let me hear what you say and what you think. I think that all of that with the drugs and the alcohol informs your work as a journalist with a kind of a plangent kind of honesty that you don't see in other reporters. There's something at the bottom of it, and I think, and here's some cheap psychology, it might be because of what you've gone through.
My dad would call it my woundedness.
Woundedness.
That I'm broken in some way, and that. So I don't simplify the story of a welfare mother because I've been a single parent, and people say, you lay around and dead. It's hell. It's a raw living hell to raise children without much money. It sucks, and so I don't. And like. The other day, Jason Blair.
A friend of yours.
Yeah, well, he was. He did some terrible things, but he's like, I'm going to be in the city. I'd like to have a cup of coffee. And I thought, well, you know, probably no good can come of this, but who am I to judge, really? And aren't I one to, like, believe in the redemptive power of all human spirit? I've been to treatment 5 times. I mean, am I going to, oh, well, that guy just about tipped over the place I work. I hate his guts. You know, who knows? Maybe he had some remarkable change in his life. And so, yeah, I went and had a cup of coffee with him.
Thank you. Mr. David Carr. I'm sure there are questions. There is a microphone over at the back, and David has kindly said that he will take any questions you have. Being Canadian, they'll be very well-mannered. They'll be polite.
You're kind of edgy, I got to say, a little bit.
Yes, guess
that's why you make the big money on the radio.
David, yes, ma'am.
David, you mentioned something that's near and dear to the heart of a lot of reporters, and that is the vetting of quotes. The advantage of being in Canada is we tend to be a little bit behind the United States. It's just starting to happen here. If you were able to do it over again, what advice would you be to journalists when people start insisting on vetting quotes?
I do think that on my beat I've made compromises that were unnecessary. And I do think that there's, again and again, the pressure to produce. It's like, how many times now am I sending questions by email and just accepting what is coming back and not asking the follow-up, and it's like jam it in and go. And I found myself lately much less patient. It's like, just run it by me afterwards. And I think to myself, A, I might forget. B, it's gonna be a huge hassle. And C, you didn't just give me the recipe for cold fusion, okay? You just gave me a quote for the story, which you're probably paid to do. And unless you think I can't type or can hear, screw you. I'm becoming a lot less patient.
What percentage of the time do you say no?
Well, yeah, I'm on the media beat, which isn't real, frankly. We write about people who write about people, who write about people. And so every once in a while, there's stakes involved in what we do. But see, I got a note from one of our really talented political reporters today, and he or she just laid out exactly how it goes, and that you got your desk banging on you. They want this last quote, and your source is saying to you, we're not gonna put her or him on the phone unless we can look at it afterwards. And so you're confronted with this Hobbesian choice. So I'm not exactly mission critical at the paper. Like for Katrina, they sent me down after the gossip columnist. as before the architecture critic, I want to point out. But people who do that level of reporting, or think of the national security reporters, I don't know what it's like for them. I just know that out in the world that I live in, I need to start drawing clearer and brighter lines. And it's a matter of training in. And if they say, the journal is more than happy to do it, you just say, well, screw the journal. We are not the Wall Street Journal. You're talking the New York Times, and this is not beanbag, man. We're going to do what we do. I talk tough, but I've collapsed plenty, you know, when I've really wanted something.
Yes, behind, right there, yes.
I'm somewhat baffled by something you said right at the start, sir, which was that journalists have to okay their quotes with the politicians before using them. Tell me I misheard. Tell me, otherwise you guys would, both of you, surely be yelling and screaming and saying democracy's ended. I misheard, didn't I?
There's a front page story on the middle of July by Jeremy Peters, my colleague,
yes.
about how how in the current campaign, many reporters are allowing campaigns to vet their quotes.
The senior staff.
Is this true?
Yes.
Must be. It was in the New York
Holy
Times.
Holy Jesus. And you still work for the New York Times when it does that?
Huh?
You still work for the New York Times when it does that?
I'm not hearing you correctly.
You still work for the New York, you continue to work for the New York Times, even though their reporters have to clear their quotes with the senior staff.
Thank you,
oh,
Michael.
You think I should quit in protest?
No, I'm asking you.
What are you saying?
I've never heard of this in this country, and I worked in the States for 10 years,
Canada's
and I never heard of it there
Everyone
either.
Everyone knows that, right?
Obviously,
but let me just take, it is pretty awful, isn't it? I mean, if you're doing a profile on somebody in the campaign and you know that you have to go to a senior staffer to get clearance for the quote, then are you not simply a stenographer rather than a reporter?
Thank you, Michael.
The story created a significant amount of stir.
Yeah.
When it occurred, and it's the kind of thing where I think the profession has to regain real estate and reacquire what was rightfully theirs in the first place. And we've been like the frogs that are slowly boiled to the point where we're letting people called spokespeople bad quotes. It's like, no, open up your mouth. I'll write something down. I'll put it in the newspaper. How about that? How about we try that, see how it goes?
Yes, Rob Barlow at the microphone. Rob.
Thank you. Just want to explore with you, if I may, like Mr. Enright, I find your column essential reading and really appreciate it. And
I bless you, I need the eggs, so keep it up.
And I miss you when you're away and they say we'll return next week. But I want to explore with you, if I may, the idea of community journalism and contributions from the community and how we maintain journalistic standards and principles. And by that I mean, I know there's a trend to have websites, local websites, where they involve community involvement and have people write in, and how do we maintain journalism as a profession that's a viable profession and with standards, and yet have people feel free that they can contribute? I mean, that's still an issue that I grapple with. I'm sure editors across North America are grappling with.
Well, in the U.S., and I'm one of the things that the really small papers doing quite well. The closer you are, if you want a mental exercise about whether you should buy a newspaper or not, think to yourself, would a picture of my kids' field hockey team be in there? And if it would, then they're probably solid. They're probably square, because to say, it's there. It's on the web. It's on, no. Want something I put on the fridge? There's my kid. The paper wrote about her. So the smaller weeklies, like in the town I live in, Montclair, there was a story about an award-winning teacher one town over who was accused of having a sexual relationship with one of her students. I totally want to know about that. I'm vested in that. It's the whole middle in the U.S. The metropolitan papers that got killed by Craigslist, lost real estate ads. Detroit stopped, people keep cars for 8 years, not three anymore. They don't advertise, and a lot of times when they want something, they go on the web to look at. The regional papers have been punished over and over, and I do worry a lot of the sort of stopgap sites in the U.S. that have started up say, well, we're going to come in where they're not. What it usually is a bunch of reporters get fired. They're on their, they're living on their payouts, right? And they say, well, let's start a website. And then after, you know, their buyouts end after 12 months, they go, hey, you know what, I gotta eat, I gotta do something else. And you see, I live in New Jersey, which is a game preserve of corruption. We need buses to haul away our corrupt officials. And the Star Ledger, I'm very sure within, let me think about this, within the next year, we'll come out 3 days a week instead of seven. You know.
If I have a very quick follow-up question. How do you foresee the industry evolving, that there'll just be a few national papers and then some cities without papers and then a lot of local websites, or?
Well, the way the newspaper industry worked historically, we had these monopolies in our various communities. People would not read us in high school, not read us in college. They'd graduate, they'd get married, they reproduce, they have to pay attention to the schools, they got to go to IKEA, they got to get a house, and we're there for them. That's all gone. People don't, they might not get married, they might not get married till they're 31, they might, you know, check. So that's all sort of gone. What I'm worried about, and Michael and I talked about this, is that pretty soon, who's going to tell you about the school system is the school system, that their website is going to become a big node of sort of communication. And you know what? When you open that up, you're going to find out things are great and they've never been better. The loss of accountability reporting over and over, independently funded, I do think is going to create a need in people to the point where they're going to be willing to pay for that information. I know the Globe and Mail is hopping over that fence. We have other local papers in the U.S. The consumers are going to have to participate, but it's going to be a smaller number than it was, and I don't think we're going to be able to fund the level of journalism that we have. Can the green shoots of either innovation or can that be crowdsourced? I don't think so. I don't think that's going to work.
That's the end of public interest journalism, what you're talking about. As the competition disappears, the Denver Post doesn't do the investigative stuff anymore. If there's a concentration of ownership, where's public interest journalism go?
Well, I mean, there are green shoots that are meaningful in the U.S. I wrote about something last week called Homicide Watch.
That nobody supported. The Washington
Post?
Nobody
supported, except then somebody wrote about them, and their Kickstarter got fully funded, and off they go, and they just sold it, the technology in Trenton. You have the Texas Tribune. But
you had to write about it before it got legs. The Wash Post didn't touch it. No, none of the big media companies would touch it. You wrote a column, and now people are talking about it.
Well, a lot of people were talking about it before. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known about it. But look at the Texas Tribune. You have database reporting about state government, which is where all the money is in the U.S. They do conferences. They do events. They have partnerships with local papers. It's storming along. It's doing very well. Some hybrid forms of journalism. But there's going to be a huge dip, and there's going to be some misery before people decide, well, this is worthy.
Yes, sir.
Hi. There was a Pew study released about a month ago, and it was about credibility, and it used the word believability. Of what use in an era of fairly partisan politics in the United States is the word believable when it comes to talking about journalism? Is there a better word we can use? Because you can believe something that's complete nonsense, and you can ignore the truth. So what is a better way to describe what we do?
I'm with you on that, because there's this whole thing about people feel entitled to their own facts, and they're always sending you links to these nutter websites and say, see, it's true. I found it on the web over and over. And there, I I've never seen a time, and I think Michael and I were talking about this, where people are more than willing to go and find their own truths over and yeah. over again. That, you know, turns out that pizza guy was paid off and the Obama campaign totally set it up. And, you know, I think people's willingness, I think people have found a way to reinforce their own beliefs, so they end up so far down the hobbit hole of their own belief system that new information doesn't make it in there.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if you've heard about our, excuse me, our mayor in Toronto, and how he refuses to talk to the city's largest paper. And I'm just wondering...
That would be the Toronto Star.
That would be the Toronto Star, yeah. I'm just wondering what the New York Times would do if the mayor of New York refused to talk to you.
Well, I do what the Toronto Star does, which is a very good metropolitan paper and stays in narrative on events. Historically, these fatwas that politicians go on don't last. I mean, you think of Joe Arpaio in Phoenix, the sheriff who wouldn't engage with the media there, in fact, sent sheriffs in the dead of night to arrest reporters. He's under federal investigation. I just think the idea that you guys are so biased or so corrupt that I'm not going to deal with it doesn't work out in the long run. When I ran a paper in Washington, D.C., the mayor wouldn't deal with us, and then came time he needed to deal with us. And what I always say to him over and over is, you know, when the smoke clears, we'll still be here. And I do think that the opening remarks that Michael made about we're not a permanent government, but we represent constancy, and we do in some instances, and I certainly think the Toronto Star qualifies in that regard, represent a segment of the people. And just because the mayor is stiff in us doesn't mean, and I mean, sometimes you have to wonder, when I've covered beats where people are not engaged, sometimes I hope they won't pick up the phone. It's just like, screw it. Go ahead. Don't take my call. See how that goes for you. See how that works out.
Yes, any other question? Pardon me, any other questions? I just want to ask you, in terms of corrective journalism, if a politician says something that is a lie or misstatement or whatever, or if a politician uses language that's not perhaps the most grammatical, or perhaps is convoluted in its intent and expression, should the reporter clean it up? Should I... If the mayor says ain't, should I say aren't?
Ooh, that's a deep one. Well, I worked at the Washington City Paper, which is a majority black city, and I came from Minnesota where everything is white. The food is white.
The snow.
The houses are white. The ground is white. And... I initially thought that in the course of editing that, you know, I should help the locals along in their discourse. That turned out to be a pretty bad mistake, I just got to say. I do think that the idiosyncrasies of human communication are one of the glories of journalism done right, and the people who are the best have an ear for dialect. And you know, let's face it, a politician misspeaking, that is music, baby. That's just like really, really great. And I always tell people, you know, back when I used to do weeklies, you know, that's not in the community's interest. And I say, well, what community are we talking about? Yeah, yeah. The one I live in, work in, pay taxes, and my kids go to school in, or some other one I don't belong to? What do you mean? I think that the responsibilities hold up a rigorous and true mirror in an ongoing way to important signals, civic and political events, and just let the chips fall.
Well, that's something you do every Monday morning.
Not really, but thanks.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure having you here. Mr. David Carr.
May I add my own personal note that it's been a real honor and privilege to have you here. And Michael, thank you for doing such a great job as the moderator. We have a couple of housekeeping matters, if you don't mind. There's a draw for the bestseller, Night of the Gun, which has created a big stir, and also the wonderful documentary, Page One, which you stole. As you're in your role. It was a wonderful documentary. So if I could ask you, David, to reach your hand into that jar and maybe haul out a card, and we'll award the package to the winner. But these are signed.
So what?
You take the thing out of the thing.
I'm taking one out.
Yeah.
Right.
And they get both.
Yeah. Right.
What if they don't like books or they don't like movies?
This crowd, I think you're safe.
I'm giving it to you.
I think you've grasped the principle.
Not looking. You're looking.
What do I do with
that? Just read that name out.
I'll read it. It's upside down. It's in Finnish. No. Enveronics Communications, Mr. Josh Cobden.
Come on down.
Come on down, Josh.
JC, where are... Here he is.
Here he is.
My God, he's 14 years old. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, two more things.
Enjoy the swag.
I hope you will consider joining us for a couple of our upcoming events in this series. The next one is October 18th. It's going to be around the working title, Reinventing the Modern Newspaper. And it will feature Michael Cook, editor of the Toronto Star, John Stackhouse, editor-in-chief of the Globe and Mail, among the panelists. And Scott White, the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Press, will be the moderator. The next one is on November 22nd, working title, The Mission of Broadcast News, featuring Wendy Freeman, the president of CTV News, Troy Reeb, senior vice president, Global News, Jonathan Witten, executive director of CBC News, and moderator Steve Paikin, who's with us tonight. In closing, I also want to thank our series sponsor, BMO Financial Group, for their wonderful support of J-Talks, and also to the Globe and Mail for sponsoring the reception, to which I invite you momentarily. It's on in a minute. And thank you very much once again, David Carr. Thank you.